The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell, and this is part two of 10 World-Changing Ideas, our two-part series produced in cooperation with Scientific American magazine. 10 World-Changing Ideas is the title of the feature story in the December 2011 issue of Scientific American, and it profiles 10 examples of cutting-edge research and tech that might change the future of society, our planet, and even our survival as a species. I'm here with Fred Guterl, the executive editor of Scientific American. Previously, Fred was a deputy editor at Newsweek and Newsweek International's first science and tech editor. His writing and editing have contributed to numerous awards and nominations from the American Society of Magazine Editors. Fred's also the author of the book Fate of the Species, about how humans are at risk of extinction and how to avoid it. And Bloomsbury will publish that in May. Now, last week, we got a great introduction to the concept behind 10 World-Changing Ideas, but I just wanted to touch on it again for anyone who might be joining us for the first time. So these are 10 potentially world-changing ideas, correct? This isn't a retrospective. You're looking for tech that you think is going to change the future?
Yes, it's too easy to look back on technologies that have already changed the world. So we're trying to anticipate what technologies might change the world. Those very simple but transformative things, like the internet, for example, that can just change the way we live.
So what would qualify a technology as potentially world-changing?
We look for things that are not really too pie in the sky, that are making their way out of the labs, that have some kind of physical manifestation, that are sort of like products, but that maybe haven't necessarily come to people's attention yet or haven't caught on in a big way, but contain the germ of an idea that we think could address one of the big things, that challenges that are out there, the problems that need to be solved, or capabilities that we might want that we don't yet have.
And you must have a million ideas to choose from. So how do you decide which projects to write about?
Well, we do lots of research and we develop a very long list of ideas and then we start winnowing things out. You know, we look for the things that are most interesting, that seem to tell the most compelling story, you know, that are in that middle range between things that are practical but are still a little bit ahead of their time. And once you begin to look at each one and hold it up and, you know, start talking to experts and that sort of thing, you get to a short list, and then that's what we go with.
Well, thanks very much for joining us, Fred.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And now, here are five more of this year's 10 world-changing ideas, as chosen by Scientific American. Dr. Eric Topol is a pioneer of genomic and wireless digital technologies. He's a practicing cardiologist at Scripps in La Jolla, California, and he's well known for leading the Cleveland Clinic to becoming the number one center for heart care. In 2009, he was selected to be one of the country's 12 rock stars of science in GQ magazine. His book, The Creative Destruction of Medicine, is due to be published by Basic Books in 2012. Now, you're here to talk about monitoring your vital signs in real time from your smartphone, but we're not talking about the health apps that are currently available on my iPhone, because those ones are less than impressive, really.
Right. The apps that are numerous today, but they're not really the transformative things that will be incorporated in the future of medicine. They're starting to head that way, but most apps today on smartphones are things for health and fitness and nutrition, and they're not sensors, for example, for the heart and for glucose and for, you know, pertinent medical things.
Well, so let's talk about that, using your phone as an ECG monitor.
You can use a phone today to actually measure blood pressure, measure glucose. There are, you know, add-on things that go to a smartphone, and you can get that data generated through the phone and then archived in the phone, graphed on the phone, transmitted, whether it's to a physician or to your Facebook friends, once you have that data captured. And then we're right at the cusp of having that data continuously captured in a seamless way whereby it can be done remotely, whether it's for a day or a week or for much longer periods of time. And this pertains to not just blood pressure, but all vital signs, including oxygen saturation, heart rhythm, body temperature, things like brain waves if need be, quantifying mood continuously, all sorts of things that really give us unique opportunities to revolutionize how healthcare is rendered today.
Well, how does it work?
You know, it's pretty straightforward, is that these sensors are relatively simple, that can be either worn. Let's say we're going to measure heart rhythm. You could have a Band-Aid on the chest, or you can even have something that goes on the case of the phone, which has sensors on it that you can put your fingers on and makes a circuit with the heart. Or you can even now have a shirt that has sensors embedded into the shirt. And then finally, there's sensors that can be put embedded into the body, into the circulation in a small vein. There's all sorts of ways that sensors can pick up vital information. It's just a matter of which sensor is appropriate for which individual to either prevent or better treat a particular condition.
Well, for anyone who might not know, what's the process like now for people with diabetes or heart problems? How do we currently monitor those illnesses?
In diabetes, there's emerging choices whereby instead of just doing finger sticks and having them stored in a particular meter called a glucometer, now that can be done directly through the phone, but that's done intermittently and it still requires a finger stick. Then there's also the continuous glucose monitor, which can be worn. It's a tiny, hair-thin needle under the skin of the abdomen, and it transmits the glucose every 5 minutes around the clock. So that's really, you know, for people who are either diabetic or have a high risk of progressing to diabetes, that can be a very useful tool. Now, for blood pressure, we have the similar thing where you can measure blood pressure intermittently, but soon that will be available, like heart rhythm, on a continuous basis so that the sampling of heart rhythm can be done when you feel dizzy or lightheaded or your heart rate is feels like it's accelerated. Or it can be done, you know, on a continuous basis for a period of time, let's say, you know, a week or a month or whatever you like.
So the benefits to using a smartphone to do this are what?
Basically, these are all capabilities that exist today where the data can be captured through a sensor that's wirelessly connected to a smartphone. And then the phone, working here as a mini computer, is basically, you know, capturing all that data and processing it, filtering it, working through, you know, algorithms to get the juice, the key data that then can be used to better manage the condition.
So I assume there's an associated decrease in cost of monitoring then.
Norman Holter invented the Holter monitor in 1946, and it's a bulky device that you have to come into the hospital or clinic and get it attached to get your heart rhythm, and you got to wear it, and then you got to come back after a day. You can't really do anything. You can't take a shower. You can't exercise. You got this box on you with all these leads. Now you can have this, you know, basically done completely through your phone. It's not yet approved in the U.S., but it's already approved in Europe. Whereby you basically, you don't feel right, you just put your fingers on the sensors on your phone and all that data is captured and you never have to show up to a medical center either to get hooked up or unhooked up. I mean, it's remarkably different and it took a lot of years, but, you know, this is the kind of emblematic of the changes that are occurring today.
Well, how accurate is it in comparison?
The cardiogram here, the heart rhythm is remarkably accurate, appears to be just as accurate as the conventional Holter monitor. So whether it's glucose or blood pressure or heart rhythm and many others, these appear to be particularly accurate.
Well, the article also mentioned that at this point the obstacle is sensor technology.
I don't believe the sensor technology is the obstacle here. I think the bigger one is dealing with the data that the sensor is capturing. That is the biggest issue because you can't just send all that data to a physician, you know, as a patient. You need to have that processed and filtered. So the sensors work really quite well, and they're, you know, the ones that have been developed so far are remarkably inexpensive to make. The sensors, the biosensors, is just one dimension of being able to have high definition man, you know, each person being digitized for essential characteristics, whether it's physiology through sensors or biology through DNA sequencing, or anatomy through advanced imaging. This is giving a picture of any individual, the likes of which we've never had before. This is why, you know, I characterize it as a potential for creative destruction in medicine, because it's such a profound, radical, disruptive innovation.
Well, in the future, it may be possible to actually detect diseases earlier due to these kind of technologies.
Absolutely. That I wrote extensively about that. That is, for the first time, we will be able to detect conditions, you know, long before they occur. And I'll give you an example of that. Autoimmune conditions like so-called type 1 diabetes, it takes 5 years on average for the pancreas islet cells to be destroyed. And we will be able to sense that, you know, long before 5 years are up, before the pancreas islet cells are destroyed, to prevent people from developing, and this is typically children around the age of 5 or so, prevent their diabetes from ever occurring. That's the opportunity that lies ahead. Genomically, we would know which children are at risk, which children need to have the sensor, and then to head this thing off years before the vital tissue of a pancreas was destroyed through the immune system. And the same sort of thing, that same logic train, can be taken over to heart attacks, to detection at the earliest possible time of cancer through cells that are in the bloodstream, and many other conditions that could be prevented through combining sensors with genomics.
So how far are we away from that, do you think?
The technology exists to do this now. That is, nanosensors that could be embedded in the circulation and in the bloodstream of a person, and these so-called molecular signatures from the cells that are getting into the bloodstream. So many of the pieces of this are already known today. It's just assembling the parts. And so it may not be that far off. Certainly for some applications, it could be in the next few years.
So you mentioned just the mass of data. Do you have anything in mind for how you're going to deal with that?
This is the biggest challenge of today in biomedicine, is that we are going to see truly a deluge of data that never had been anticipated, because, you know, just sequencing a human genome and doing that, you know, in millions of people ultimately, no less all the data coming from these continuous sensors, this is, of course, a big, big challenge. Processing that data and you know, that analytical side of this is really the rate limiting step today. It's easy to get a sequence of a human genome, but it's not so easy to have it all fully interpreted. And the same thing as I mentioned with the sensors. It's not that hard to have a sensor that could pick up whatever metric you're interested in, but being able to process that data in a meaningful way that's practical, that's going to help patients, help people, that's the bigger challenge.
That was Dr. Eric Topol, cardiologist at Scripps and pioneer of genomic and wireless digital technologies. Michael Moyer is the senior editor in charge of technology coverage for Scientific American. Previously, he spent 8 years at Popular Science magazine, where he was the articles editor. So we're going to be talking about a new development in mining. Now, how have we traditionally mined for metals?
Mining really hasn't changed all that much since the Bronze Age. You collect an ore, a big piece of rock that you suspect has some metals in it, and you apply heat and some sort of chemical agent, most typically coke, which is a type of charcoal, and from that you're able to extract the metals out of it. Now, that process requires a whole lot of energy, which can make it very expensive. What people have been turning increasingly towards in recent years is using microbes to do the work for us. There are a number of bacteria who love to eat this stuff and generate acids and other materials that help pull the metal out of the ore in a much more efficient way. People have been using this for a long time for very precious metals such as gold. People are now finding that it's becoming economical to use it for metals such as copper. What we were really excited about, though, is not being able to just extract more metals out of the ore. It's using microbes to be able to clean up the leftovers. One of the things that people find with ores is that you can only extract so much, and then you get down to low concentrations of metals are left over, and it doesn't make any more sense to try and pull more metal out. with bacteria, you can get down to the last little bits, and even the tailings, the bits that would ordinarily just be waste and be dumped, you can apply microbes to those, and they actually help clean up these old mine sites.
What kind of microbes are these?
Different microbes are used for different processes. The microbes that are used for the traditional mining techniques are, and you'll excuse me if I mess up these huge Latin names, Acylidobacillus or Lepsospirillium, in case you're thinking about growing some at home. The microbes that are used for cleaning up the old waste are bacteria such as the Desulfobribio and Desulfotomaculum bacteria, and I hope I got those right. And those bacteria neutralize acids, and they create these sulfides that end up bonding to copper, nickel, and other metals, pulling them out of solution.
So what are the advantages of biomining then?
One of the major advantages of biomining is that it uses a whole lot less energy than traditional mining. Metals are really going up in value, and so it makes a lot more sense to try and extract as much as you can. Energy is also fairly expensive. And so what these biomining techniques allow you to do is not only to be able to extract the metals using a lot less energy, but also to extract metals from ores which have the metals in very, very low concentrations.
You're saying this isn't a terribly new process, but what percentage of mining is done via microbe at this point?
Right now, about 20% of the world's copper production is coming from biomining, and that figure is really increasing over the years. What we're looking for in the future is for biomining to be used more and more for mine cleanup, which right now is too expensive for it to be economically justified. The experts expect that in 5 or 10 years, this process becomes economical. It gets to the point where you're able to pull enough metal out of what was waste to be able to use it and to be able to sell that metal on the open market. That's when we hope that this microbe mining techniques will not only be able to get more metals out of the ore, but to be able to clean up what's there. To be able to make that process really economically viable, to make mine owners want to do that instead of have to do that.
That was Michael Moyer, the senior editor in charge of technology coverage for Scientific American. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be right back with more of Scientific American's world-changing ideas after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
David Weinberger is a senior researcher at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society and co-director of the Harvard Library Innovation Laboratory. He's the author of several books on the effect of the internet on ideas and of the upcoming Too Big to Know, about what the net is doing to knowledge. Now, you wrote the article, The Machine That Would Predict the Future, about something called the Future ICT Knowledge Accelerator and Crisis Relief System. Now, that's a big name for a big project. What is it?
The idea behind the project is that there have been multiple crises over the past few years of various sorts, economic, meteorological diseases. And you would think that with all of the data that we have available, we should be able to predict them at this point. And so the proposal is to the European Commission as part of one of their projects for a €1 billion grant over 10 years to create a system that will allow policymakers to ask questions and get answers.
So now it's the brainchild of Dirk Helbing, who's also created highway traffic models, and he's also consulted on projects that model the movement of pedestrians. So he's done this before, sort of.
Yes, and when he presents it, at least in public, he uses the success that he and others have had in modeling traffic, both vehicular and pedestrian, as evidence that therefore we can scale up and model events that he realizes quite explicitly depend upon the intersection of multiple hugely complex domains of human life and geological events and basically everything. Anything that could affect human behavior, which is basically anything that happens on the planet.
So let's just be clear. The project is supposed to model the world's social, biological, political, and physical forces and use them to predict the future.
Yes.
So how exactly are they going to go about that?
Well, you do the computer thing of building models of the various subsystems, say, of weather or traffic or the spread of epidemics or of various forms of human behavior and interaction. And these models, they take a set of rules about how factors interact, what we know about how factors interact, and the huge amounts of data that are now becoming available. You plug the data into the rules. You do something more sophisticated than that, which is you use the data to see if you can derive new rules. You look at the feedback loops that emerge, and you integrate the models across all these disciplines, because whether there are going to be riots in a particular country may well depend upon the harvest conditions in another country, which may well depend upon the weather conditions somewhere else, and whether there's a volcano interrupting and so forth. You integrate all of these models, and you provide probabilistic answers to policy queries. Dr. Helbing refers to this as a flight simulator for policy. You know, as if you can step in and try out different maneuvers and see which ones crash and burn and which ones get you to land safely.
Now, creating models of complex systems in order to predict outcomes is really nothing new. Climate science does it quite well, correct?
It's certainly nothing new, not over the past 60 or 70 years or so. And some models work quite well. The weather models work really well up to a few days. Beyond that, one of the experts that I talked with in the area of weather modeling thinks that there's, and thinks that it's generally accepted that there's a sort of a methodological limit of about 15 days for predicting weather forecasts. But it's gotten, certainly weather forecasting through models has gotten better and better over the past few decades, up to a few days out, where it's now, you know, sort of reliable.
But we're talking about taking into account the behavior of people. Now, that's far more difficult. Isn't that one of the reasons that economic models aren't anywhere near as accurate as we would like?
I think the very positive thing about this proposal is that it highlights one of the important changes, which is that there is now so much data being generated, far beyond what even a few years ago were available, that it's possible to make some types of predictions of human behavior that we simply were not fathomable before, were not possible before. And so this is an area that many people, and many of the people that I spoke with in researching the article, they're very, very excited about. I think the difficulty comes from thinking that we'll be able to combine multiple models. It's the scalability of models that I think raises questions about this approach. On the other hand, as I say, there's hope that because the data has so scaled up that there may well be other ways of extracting predictions or information or knowledge from this gigantic set of data, this data cloud that has emerged.
That's actually one of the things that I love so much about this. Predictions would have to take so many variables into account. So it would have to look at situations from dozens of perspectives, like economic perspectives and environmental and social perspectives. So if you could do that, the policy decisions that could come out of it would be so much more balanced than they are now. But I also see that as being very, very difficult.
Yes, I mean, you multiply the difficulty of modeling as you plug together models that are themselves complex. You can imagine a small change in one of the areas of life that's being modeled having gigantic effects on a different area. A small error in the weather predictions or the climate predictions might have a gigantic snowball effect, the butterfly effect, on the overall prediction about what you should do about the euro crisis or whatever.
Well, something that you wrote was really interesting to me about how a model's conclusions can alter the situation that it's modeling.
That's the feedback loop idea. One of the most common examples is if you had a model that predicted movement of stocks, you were a stock expert and you started following that model and buying up or selling, your behavior would affect the stock. And so you have to take account of this looping behavior. And those sorts of loops happen all over the place, especially with anything touching human behavior, because we'll change our mind in an instant. The swarm of humans, the flock of humans who are moving in a particular direction, will suddenly veer based upon one of these feedback loops. And Dr. Helping's proposal is aware of this effect and hopes to take them into account. It can be difficult to do, of course.
So you can actually potentially build in the presentation of a prediction to the model itself.
Yes, you have to be continuously taking in new data and being aware when a variance in that data is in fact affecting the performance of the model.
So how long would you need to gather data before you'd see an accurate prediction?
You need lots of data, and there is lots of data, but you also need highly tuned models that are integrated well enough that they work together, which adds to the complexity very, very significantly. There's also the problem that very small changes in complex systems, which is what we're talking about, highly complex systems. This is human behavior, and the Earth systems are themselves highly complex. The weather by itself is highly complex. That is, it's extremely difficult, if not impossible, to predict an outcome by following a causal chain through the mass of chaotic, fully determined but chaotic interactions. Such systems are famous for being highly sensitive to initial conditions or to small changes. And that's what the butterfly effect is about. Some tiny event that you would never have predicted would have a snowball cascading effect, in fact, does. You can't predict it because in a chaotic or in a highly complex system, you can't actually even follow the chain.
Well, and that's actually something that you wrote, that our puny human brains might actually not even understand the predictions. I'm paraphrasing.
Which raises another problem for trying to build a machine that policymakers can rely on. Because the machine will have value only if it, or primarily if it's telling us to do things we wouldn't have done otherwise. I mean, confirming that common sense or what you were going to do is the right thing would be highly valuable, but becomes way more valuable, especially when you're trying to avert the sort of crises that is motivating this project. It becomes much more valuable when it's telling us something we wouldn't have thought to do. That's when it really pays off. But if you have a policymaker who is doing something that goes against common sense, goes against expectations because this wonderful machine is telling us to, how is the policymaker ever going to sell it to her or his constituents?
Right.
If she or he cannot explain why it makes sense, saying, well, the machine told us to is going to be very unpopular and pretty scary way of proceeding. And Victoria Stodden, who's one of the people I interviewed, gave the example. Suppose the machine says that in order to avert some crisis that we didn't even know was looming, it knows that we don't, and it says, what you need to do is burn all your oil wells, set them on fire. And that might actually be the right advice, but you cannot imagine a policymaker saying, well, I'm going to the public and saying, yes, citizens, we're going to do this because a computer told us to. So there are reasons to think that even if we had such a machine, it would be giving us advice that we might not be able to follow for political and very human reasons.
Now, obviously, not everyone agrees that this project is the way to go. Some people are proposing a more open source method.
Yes, I mean, one of the reasons that I'm really interested in the Helbing project is because it seems to me to make clear a line between what is now, I think, a traditional way. It's a short tradition because we're just talking about the computer era, but a traditional way of proceeding and a new one that's been emerging over the past few years, over the past 5 years or so. The traditional way tries to build a model, assumes that we can know enough about how the world works, how the levers interact and so forth, the wheels and the cogs. And you build a machine and it, you know, we hope that it works. The alternative that's emerging is much more like a data commons. It's more chaotic and less controlled and less planned ahead of time. What both have in common, by the way, is a great deal of excitement about the possibilities afforded by the growth of these gigantic clouds of data. So the data commons approach says, yeah, there's huge amounts of data coming into availability, public availability. the best way for science to proceed with this, there's huge promise in it, is for lots of people to try lots of different approaches, including lots of different sorts of models. Traditional models, new types of models, ways of predicting that are not necessarily model-based, at least not in the old way. Have lots and lots and lots of them. Have them sharing data. Have them arguing with one another. John Wilbanks was one of the people I spoke with about Science Commons, put it in a way that I really liked, and I'm going to paraphrase here, but pretty closely. He said, what's really important is that your nerds argue with my nerds. The difference in vision is between thinking that we can ever get all of this right, we can lay down the principles, we can march data through those principles as if it was a well-oiled machine and be confident of what's going to come out. That's one idea, and that's how traditionally science has been attracted to that hope. The cloud-based, the common-based view says, you know, science is a more human enterprise, and we're never going to have a fully oiled machine that we can just crank. It's always going to be a matter of scientists arguing with scientists, marshaling the best evidence that they can, disagreeing, changing their minds, joining up, getting insights that other people disagree with. And the overall argument that ensues is science, is knowledge, is the best knowledge that we have. It's uncertain, of course. It's in contention. The contention never fully ends. But that's where its strength is. It's in your nerds arguing with my nerds.
That was glorious, sir. I love that. So then what do you think about all this? Because your new book, you've looked at a lot of these.
First of all, I'm really excited about the amount of data that's becoming available openly in the world. The fact that people will release data, even in its raw form, in order to get it out there so that it can start being pulled together and sifted through by people who the originators of the data may never have anticipated would find value in it. That, to me, is amazing. And I think both sides in this discussion agree. I'm also very hopeful that our new view of knowledge, the one that is emerging in Science Commons, but also in fields outside of science, basically anything that the internet is touching, that this new view of knowledge is enabling us to know more than we ever could. The world was always way too big for any particular skull. Skulls are really small and limited. And our old technique, because of the medium that we had, which was a paper medium, paper's very small also. It's very limited. And so our idea of knowledge got wrapped around the nature of paper. And so our idea of knowledge was that it was what goes through careful filters and we're quite certain about and is settled the way that a published book can't really change once the ink is committed to paper. That it drives out disagreement and difference. It's all about settling matters sort of once and for all, and then it's knowledge. And publishing it in a medium that, for all of the glory of books and paper, it's a very disconnected medium. You can't just touch a footnote and get the other volume. And so we invented a type of knowledge that was more self-contained and discrete. When you look at the sort of data that's coming available in these various commons, these data clouds, it's fully linked. The data itself consists of links. It's so connective that it's magnetic in every direction. It just wants to pull together with other sorts of data. And that's what we see happening. It's knowledge as much bigger, but in contention, not settled, but well argued, connected in ways that we could never, ever have thought of before. And to me, this is a huge change in the nature of knowledge, and one that is a tremendous breakthrough for us as a species.
Holy, I'm looking forward to your book. That was David Weinberger, senior researcher at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society, and author of the upcoming book, Too Big to Know, about what the net is doing to knowledge. Fred Guterl is the executive editor of Scientific American. He's also the author of the book, Fate of the Species, about how humans are at risk of extinction and how to avoid it, which Bloomsbury will publish in May. Now we're going to be talking about computers that don't freeze up, and the thought of that makes me ridiculously happy, so thank you. But it's odd. Although I spend the vast majority of my time, really, on my computer, I have only the most vague understanding of how it works. So can you explain it in laypeople language?
Basically, you have a processor in there, which it crunches everything, does everything. It's kind of like a traffic cop. and then you've got different applications running at the same time. So say you've got a word processor, and then you've got Skype, and then you've also got your email program, and a bunch of other things are running in the background. I don't know if you've ever had the experience where you're trying to write an email and you're typing and nothing's happening because the computer has decided that it wants to update some software or it wants to go do something that it's scheduled to do or that comes up for it to do, but it actually keeps you from doing what you need to do, and that's a problem. The computer has decided it needs to do something else and it's not going to tend to your business. What we wrote about is software being worked on at MIT in a project called Angstrom. They're developing software that will give the computer a little bit of intelligence and allow it to assess all the things that it's doing and prioritize them. Let's say you're watching streaming video, and the streaming video needs to work at a certain pace or else you won't have your video. It'll just freeze up. And this new software that MIT is working on will allow the computer to say, wait a second, I can't devote all these computing resources to doing all these other things because I got to keep this video running at 30 frames per second or whatever it is. And it sounds kind of simple, but this would actually change the experience of using these things quite a lot.
Well, exactly, because it is very annoying for me personally when my smartphone freezes or when my computer freezes, but it's a far bigger deal when we're talking about supercomputers in a lab, right?
Well, supercomputers in a lab is one thing, but I think really we're talking about the computers that everyone else uses too. You know, we're talking about smartphones, we're talking about PCs, we're talking about all this stuff. This is also applicable to supercomputers. I mean, they need to have the ability to prioritize too. But, you know, this could go right down to your smartphone. You know, everyone's probably had the experience of, you know, you're using your GPS, you're trying to call your map up, and you're driving your car. Well, hopefully you're the passenger and someone else is driving. But you're pulling up and you're trying to get the map to help you know whether to turn left or right, and the thing won't work because, you know, it's downloading something or it's doing something else. And that's, I think, even more than in supercomputers, I think it would have changed people's lives on a day-to-day basis.
Well, tell us about Project Angstrom.
Well, Project Angstrom is at MIT, and they've developed this software called Application Heartbeats. And the thing that makes this really crucial is that as computers get more and more complicated, you know, I talked about how you have a processor in there that acts as a traffic cop. Well, they're actually making computers that have more than one of these processors. And, you know, there are a lot of them out there that have two or four. And down the road, there'll be machines that have potentially thousands of these things. So these are thousands of little processors that are each acting independently. And when you get to systems of that size, you need to have some way of knowing, you know, one hand needs to know what the other is doing, especially when you have 1,000 hands. So that was the motivation behind this.
This is described as self-aware software, but not in the artificial intelligence sense, right?
No, just self-aware in terms of what it's doing, what its priorities are. So artificial intelligence implies that it has a kind of a human-like intelligence, but that's not really what they're talking about here. It's more of a very focused and very pragmatic thing.
But the article did say that the software would also be able to learn from its own experience.
That's right, yeah. So it does have elements of what kind of used to be called artificial intelligence. Computer scientists don't like that phrase very much anymore because it's sort of splintered into these different parts. You know, you'll have natural language processing, which deals with how you get a machine to understand the spoken language. And this is more kind of like planning and scheduling, which is kind of the thing that Mars rovers have to do. You know, you get a Mars rover that's working millions of miles away and it only has a small window of data to send back and forth. And so it has to make a lot of decisions on its own. So it has to prioritize what it does. So it has to say, I just took 5,000 pictures of the Martian landscape. Which one do I send back? Which is the one that the scientists really want to see? So it's sort of similar to that. So this software is sitting there and it's thinking, I've got all these things going. How much of my resources should I put to each one?
So what's standing in the way of making this happen right now?
It's under development. It's a field of artificial intelligence that's grown from theory and it's growing into practice. So you've got software out there that's doing very high-level things that are very expensive to do, you know, like Mars rovers, where you need teams of really smart PhDs to work on this stuff. So they're trying to now, broadly speaking, they're trying to bring this technology down to push it out, you know, so that more and more people can use it. It's not that expensive. It's easier to work with. So this is one way of doing that. So if they're taking this form of artificial intelligence, they're applying it to this one problem of how you get a computer to allocate its resources in a smart way. So these scientists are doing that in a lab, and they've got a prototype, which works pretty well. But a prototype isn't exactly a product. You know, you can't buy it from on the shelves yet. It has to go through another level of development. It's sort of like when General Motors makes a concept car. You know, you can drive it around the test track, but it's not quite ready to be stamped out in a factory.
Well, how long until my laptop doesn't freeze when I'm multitasking, I guess is what I'm asking.
Well, it's not going to be in time for the holiday season next year. Probably 3 to 5 years, I'm guessing.
I can wait that long. Not that I really have a choice.
Well, you'll become much more productive in 3 to 5 years, let's put it that way.
Thanks.
You'll have to do more work.
Oh, I like that too. That was Fred Gutterl, the executive editor of Scientific American. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be right back with more of Scientific American's world-changing ideas after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking at some of nature's most accomplished material scientists and the amazing substance they produce. We're joined by Leslie Brunetta, co-author of the book Spider Silk, Evolution and 400 Million Years of Spinning, Waiting, Snagging, and Mating. We'll discuss the form, function, and uses of the sticky wonder material and the ways that its study can help us understand evolution. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Christopher Mims is a journalist who specializes in sustainability and technology. He blogs for Technology Review, Grist, Smart Planet, and Fast Company, and writes articles for Wired, Scientific American, Technologist, and Slate. Tell us about cognitive computing.
Put briefly, cognitive computing is those silicon brains that we've been reading about since practically the invention of science fiction.
Right.
I mean, it's quite literally the invention of silicon brains. For many, many years, we've been simulating neurons and what are called neural nets within computers. And they have some interesting properties, which, you know, when you take a few of the basic features of how the nervous system in practically any vertebrate works, and you put those features into artificial cells or connections inside a computer, you can teach these systems to learn. So most of us have probably heard of systems that can, you know, learn how to spell check in the English language. That's kind of a classic example. The problem with all these systems is that when you simulate neurons, it's fairly slow because you're asking at a very fundamental level a digital computer, which really at its heart traditionally only has a single channel for computations to pass through, to simulate a neural network where you have many, many neurons all operating at the same time. So in computing, this is called parallelism. So if you're talking about a supercomputer, supercomputer is a lot more like the human brain in that it has many thousands of processors working in parallel. Well, the human brain, each one of our processors is pretty slow, but we have so many of them working at the same time that we can tackle these really big problems. So the folks at IBM, with some money from basically the Department of Defense, have created artificial neurons in silicon. They're not an attempt to faithfully reproduce real neurons. They're just an attempt to distill the 4 or 5 features of regular neurons that are relevant for simulating, you know, very primitive cognition as we know it. So far, what they've managed to do is take 256 of these silicon neurons, put them on a single chip. It can do very basic things. It can beat you at Pong, stuff like that. Their ultimate goal is to take 10 billion of these silicon neurons, which would have 100 trillion synapses, so basically connections between them. And that's about the scale of 1/2 of a human brain. And they want to get there in about a decade. And importantly, these 10 billion artificial neurons together should only use about 1,000 watts of power, so 1,000 watt light bulbs. And the reason that's significant is that currently that many processors in a supercomputer, say, it would take its own power plant. So that's the other feature of the human brain that's so great, is that it's extremely energy efficient compared to traditional digital computers. This represents kind of a sea change in how we approach computing, because and they won't tell you this up front, but if you ask them, they make it explicit. Massively parallel systems like this that resemble nervous systems, they're so complicated, and there's so many potential what they call states for this device to be in, that you simply can't program them.
Really?
You can only teach them. That's the only way you're ever going to get information into this system.
How would that work?
Basically, in neuroscience, you have something called Hebb's rule. Neurons that fire together wire together. Let's say you're trying to teach a simple cognitive computer to recognize a shape like the number 2 written out or something. You have to set up a kind of a testing paradigm where when it gets the answer right or gets close to the right answer, it's basically given a reward.
Wow.
And so every time that this cognitive computer gets an answer right, the connections between its artificial neurons that led to that correct answer are reinforced as per Hebb's rule. And eventually, after many trials and maybe thousands of trials, you reinforce all the right connections, and the system has learned to, in this case, represent or recognize the number 2. I mean, and this is how, as we understand it, learning happens in regular nervous systems as well, biological nervous systems.
Could you explain how artificial neurons are made?
They're made in the exact same way that conventional computer chips are. The difference is that their architecture is fundamentally different. So in a traditional, what's called von Neumann architecture, after the guy who invented it, you are processing one instruction after another sequentially through a single processor. So the only way to speed that process up is to make that chip run faster and faster. So modern microprocessors like the one in your PC are running at many gigahertz. You can't make them much faster without them basically just overheating and melting down. So there's a limit to how fast we can make these processors. So when you're making an artificial neuron, your approach is totally different. They're made the exact same way that regular chips are, in the same facilities and with the same technology, the same people in clean rooms and bunny suits etching things into silicon wafers. But their physical layout is such that they're communicating with each other through these synapses, through these connections. So instead of having a single chip that's running extremely quickly, you have hundreds or thousands of etched artificial neurons that are all running at the same time, i.e. in parallel.
So what can't conventional computing do that cognitive computing could?
Right now, there's nothing that cognitive computing can do that conventional computing couldn't, except that cognitive computing can do things that conventional computing can do much more efficiently from a power perspective. But in the future, as you scale up cognitive computing, that power advantage, which is the real limiting factor on how powerful computers can be right now, means that if you had, you know, what they're projecting, which is something the size of a shoebox with 10 billion artificial neurons in it, it could do things that no supercomputer today could do. The thing is, we wouldn't necessarily recognize those things as conventional computing tasks. So because cognitive computers can't be programmed, they can only be taught, they're better at fuzzy tasks. I mean, there's another thing that's worth knowing about a cognitive computer, which is that, like real nervous systems, they're bad at math.
Really?
Regular computers.
That's comforting.
Yeah, so it's much more efficient to add 2 large numbers in a conventional computer than in a cognitive computer. The thing that cognitive computers are better at are these fuzzy pattern recognition tasks that conventional nervous systems are well suited to. So if you look at a very quote-unquote primitive nervous system, like one in an insect or something, they're very good at simple tasks like recognizing a small dot moving across their field of view at a particular speed, because that task might be relevant to their survival, because that could be a predator or it could be prey.
Right.
So a cognitive computer would be really good at, let's say, face recognition. And the way that this was described to me is that cognitive computing in general will be used as the interface between the fuzzy, messy real world and the world of perfection and numbers and symbols that's currently handled by conventional computers. So you might have a cognitive computer that is 24 hours a day searching the feed from every security camera in London, let's say, which is covered with security cameras, looking for one face. And when it recognizes that face, and this task, by the way, would take a lot of conventional computing power, it's going to turn that into a symbol, you know, I found John Smith or Jane Doe, and hand that off to a conventional computer, because a conventional computer can handle a discrete symbol like someone's identity and then act on it. So cognitive computers will be used, I mean, frankly, for the kind of tasks that we now use human brains for right now. There's no evidence, though, that just because you cram 10 billion artificial neurons into a small space, that it's going to become self-aware or that it will have
any
kind of
my mind, sir.
Consciousness or metacognition. I mean, the human brain is extraordinarily complicated, not just because it's an accident of evolution, but probably because, you know, having anything that resembles consciousness requires a very particular kind of interconnection. And that's the final feature of cognitive computers that we should know about. There's one thing that nervous systems do that they absolutely do not do. In a regular nervous system, when you learn a new task, very often a neuron will grow a new connection to another neuron somewhere else in the brain. Sometimes these connections can be quite distant. Because these are made out of silicon and silicon is not alive, it doesn't move or grow, a cognitive computer can't grow new connections between its individual neurons. So it's not going to wake up one day or turn into Skynet or anything like that. But it will probably tackle problems that we haven't even thought of yet, because that's the trend in computing, is oftentimes computing enables us. It provides us with solutions before we even know what the problem is. And then we say, oh, great, we can do this. So let's invent a whole new class of things that we feel are necessary so we can solve it with these devices we have.
Well, are there any specific obstacles that they're running into right now?
At this point, it's so preliminary that I don't know that there are specific obstacles. I mean, I think that, you know, in the course of reporting this piece, I talked to a neuroscientist who is familiar with kind of both sides of this, both the electrical engineering and the neuroscience side of this. And I mean, he pointed out that for decades, we've been simulating neural nets on conventional computers. And that's what this is. It's a neural net. It's just, instead of simulating it, we actually built it physically. And neural nets are useful. And if you search the literature, they are finding new applications every day. I mean, that's what real artificial intelligence is. Real artificial intelligence is teaching computers and robots to kind of abstract the world and make decisions based on that information. But all of these abilities are what you would think of in the biological world as kind of the abilities of like insects or, you know, colonies of bacteria. There's no long-term planning going on here. There's no abstract thinking. It's just about pattern recognition, extracting signal from noise. So there's yet to be any evidence that this will lead to anything beyond kind of these very basic sensory abilities.
Well, now I'm wondering, you've been involved in at least the last 2 years of this World-Changing Ideas feature on Scientific American. So do you follow updates on any of the tech that were covered in past editions?
I do, and it's been gratifying to see this technology come to fruition. I mean, obviously not all of this is going to show up in a shop front someday. For instance, when we talked earlier about the wallet in your hand using biometrics to make purchases, that exact form of that technology may or may not show up, but something like it came out, you know, a month after I filed the piece, which was this kind of smartphone-based technology which incorporates both your proximity and your face to allow you to make purchases. I mean, another example is a couple of years ago, I wrote about the fact that the biggest breakthrough in solar technology wasn't in technology at all. It was in this financing model where companies like SolarCity and Sunrun and Sungevity will give you solar panels for free, and then you buy the electricity that those panels produce from the company, and they guarantee that the rate that you're paying is lower than what you would pay your utility company. And, you know, there's all this kind of financing wizardry on the back end of it. It's not that complicated. But, you know, when we wrote about that, it seemed like, wow, this is such a no-brainer. Maybe this will lead to something. And at the time, there were municipalities trying to do it. But in the past couple of years, it's really blown up. I mean, Google put more than $100 million into one of the companies doing this called Sungevity. You know, they've expanded from state to state. So one of the things I like about Scientific American's World Changing Ideas package is that while there is a gee whiz factor, it's always about something that is very real, that's fairly close at hand, and whether or not you're going to see it in the world as it's been described in this package, it's going to have an important impact downstream. Something inspired by it or something like it will come along and have kind of unexpected effects on our material world.
Just off the top of your head, what do you think would be sort of the success rate of the past ideas?
Well, that's always going to depend on your perspective, because you can always say only one of the dozen world-changing ideas from 2 years ago has come to fruition, but that's just because the other ones are going to take a while. So there's this joke in some technologies that such and such is always 5 years away.
Right.
And a lot of it in the end comes down to economics. People come up with these cool ideas. The question is, can it be made affordable? And if it can, then it will show up. And if it can't, then it's a novelty and only academics know about it.
So do you want to speculate about this year's world-changing ideas?
Sure. I mean, I think that in terms of new battery chemistries, whether they're flow batteries or this new nanoscale battery technology, they're at the stage where they have serious investment. Some scientists can't commercialize their discoveries, but the folks behind this new type of liquid battery have had commercial success in the past. I would be surprised if within 5 years they didn't have something on the market. Whether or not it will ever make it into an electric car or be something that you can pump at some analog of a gas station, that I'm much more skeptical about. So I think they will sell it eventually and it will have an impact. It might be invisible to us, though. It might be just hidden away on the grid somewhere. As far as biometrics being used as a payment system in concert with other markers, there's no reason why we couldn't move toward this. It's basically comes down to mindset. I mean,
right.
If you think about it, a credit card is an extremely insecure object to sort of gatekeep your financial identity. And this is why people's credit cards get stolen all the time. And this is a classic example of economics. The reason that big banks continue to use credit cards, this security expert told me, is that the failure rate of credit cards is tolerable. So they're able to use their big computer systems to figure out when a credit card has been stolen enough that they're still making money on credit cards, so they don't care. So I think what's going to happen is you're going to see these small-scale applications where individual consumers want to use biometrics, and that's going to become more common. So there are banks in Japan where there's an additional layer of security where you stick your finger into a little cuff, looks at the pattern of veins in your finger, and that's one of the ways that it verifies your identity. I mean, if a single major retailer decided to adopt this, and my bet is someplace like Starbucks, because they seem to love experiment with this, you know, it would be really great to be able to walk in and they see your face or you flash your hand and you just bought a coffee. I mean, I guarantee that if a company thinks that this will increase their single store sales figures, which is what determines their stock price, they'll adopt it.
Christopher, you've been lovely. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Christopher Mims, sustainability and technology journalist. This episode of Skeptically Speaking was produced in cooperation with Scientific American magazine. We'd like to thank everybody at Scientific American for helping us bring it to you, with an extra special thank you to Rachel Shear. Rachel is a publicist for the magazine, and without her help, this whole thing would not have been possible. You'll find a link to Scientific American's 10 World-Changing Ideas article, and part one of this show, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com.
While you're there, click the links to find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, and on iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.